Hey, Larry.
Hey, Andy.
I got a phone call today from someone, and one of the comments that he made was that he said that the registry is unconstitutional. And I replied back to him that the registry itself isn't unconstitutional, but perhaps there are things within our restrictions that are unconstitutional. So I wanted to talk to you about how we could go back to where this all comes from and what might define whether the registry is constitutional or not, and I don't know, to push the limit, see what it would take to make the registry unconstitutional. So could you walk us back through how we got here on the registry with the timeline? Take us back to around 1994 where things got started.
Well, that would be where the modern registry started, would be in the 1990s. The state of California had a registry that they started in 1947, I believe, but they were the only state that did a registration of sex offenders. Registries, in terms of people convicted of crimes, have a much longer history. A lot of states have registered convicted felons. If a person has a felony conviction, they would have to report into a local law enforcement and register within a certain amount of hours. But in terms of the sex offender registry, the federal impetus that pushed the states to move was the Jacob Wetterling Act in 1994, and there was a high profile cases. In fact, recently been solved with the disappearance of Jacob, and Congress wanted to respond to that high profile case to try to figure out a better way to track and monitor people who had been convicted of crimes against children. So they passed the Wetterling Act in 1994. And within that passage of the Wetterling Act, it was strongly encouraged that the states enact sex offender registration legislation, and they were given 3 years to do that. And all states did, within the 3 year time frame, enact some version of registration. Some states enacted more requirements than others, but all states had followed that encouragement from Congress to pass and enact a registration of offenders. So that's where the modern registry started, would be with the push from Congress in 1994 with the Jacob Wetterling Act.
Okay, so like you said, only California had some form of registry, and then in 94 they started the Jacob Wetterling Act. And something significant happened in 1996 then.
Well, what happened in 1996 was, to my recollection, was that they expanded the Wetterling Act had been passed, but they wanted to make the registry public and viewable to the citizens. So they passed Megan's Law to stack on to the Wetterling Act. And states that had passed registration requirements for sex offenders had most had not imposed the requirement that they be posted publicly. And in fact, the internet was relatively young,
Sure.
and there weren't so many websites out there, but the reach of the registry was expanded by making offenders public. So Megan's Law transformed what was a law enforcement registry, which most of the felon registries that were in place through the ages, they had been simply with law enforcement. So with the advent of modern technology, the registration of sex offenders, Megan was the little girl that had been victimized by a person who had a prior conviction, and there was the outcry, why didn't we know that that person was coming back into our neighborhood? And the solution was to make the information available to the public via the internet.
We run into that even today with what good does it do to have the knowledge that the person around the corner up the street, across the street, is a convicted, I don't care what you fill in the blank there, they could be a convicted murderer or whatever. What is that, how does that benefit the public to have that information public?
Well, in terms of convicted felons, since the other registries prior to sex offender registration, the citizens, without going through great effort, didn't know about these offenders that were next door. But the theory of the sex offender registry was that the sex offenders were always lurking. If they've been convicted of these type of crimes, they have urges that are uncontrollable. So it was argued by the proponents that the mere knowledge would allow people to take precautions for their families and for their children, and it would improve public safety by merely having the knowledge. That That was the proponent's argument, that without the knowledge, you can't prepare.
Sure. And so after that, so I guess post 1996, have there been any significant changes to the registry since then?
Been a continuing flurry of changes since 1996. The registry started out relatively benign in terms of what was required. They're very much akin to the felon registries, where you just simply provided information to law enforcement in the early days, and periodically you had to either mail in a form or visit with a local law enforcement and confirm that you still lived at that address, that all the information that they had was correct and current. But the victims' advocates and the law enforcement apparatus, as with anything that's created, they saw how they could make it more overreaching and better in their definition. So they started imposing additional restrictions. So if you were to look at the trajectory of registration in most states, if you come back to the 1990s and you looked at the number of offenses that they required on a person in the first version, and then you compared it with today's version, you would see how much dramatically they've changed. There were no restrictions on where a person could work.
Right.
There were in the original versions, there were no restrictions on where people could live. It was merely a process of registering and providing information to law enforcement. But they have been nonstop trying to think of new things to restrict offenders from doing. They restrict them now from accessing internet, social media, parks, lakes, any places where children may congregate, regardless of whether or not the offense has anything to do with a child. The merely being on the registry really restricts a person in terms of what they can do. And it's just an unbelievable list of things that's been piled on. Now they've restricted so many places where they can live. Now the next version of what they've been doing lately is restricting that they can congregate, because once you isolate to a small geographic area, in an industrial area, then they find that there's too many of them congregating in the slivers of land where they can live, or in the apartment houses that will actually rent to them. So now they're passing laws to prevent a certain number of offenders from being the same address, from having more than a certain number of offenders. They restrict access to, in some cases, I think the state of Oklahoma has just passed a law that says everybody on the registry has to register their children with the Department of Human Services within 3 days. And that becomes effective November 1st. So they haven't run out, and they probably are not likely to run out of things to continue to restrict and pile on to what was supposed to be a simple registration scheme.
I it's a terrible smirk, but I have a smirk on my face of registering your children. And so what is the hopes of the politicians having the children be identified?
I just recently became aware of that, and the Oklahoma group did not have a presence in the Capitol to right. feed us information at the national level to know exactly what was going on and what the impetus was. But from what information I can gather, they feel that the proponents argued that children living in homes of sex offenders, even biological children, but especially non-biological children, might be at risk. So apparently this legislation is going to direct the human services to consider investigating the homes to find out about the well-being and safety of the children. So what you're going to have, if it plays out like I expect, was you're going to have state employees showing up at registered citizens' homes demanding to do an investigation to find out if the children have any needs or neglect, and it's going to turn into a possible witch hunt, is our fear. So we're looking at the national level of possibly doing some litigation to stop this from going into effect.
That's just amazing. But so I guess I read a study somewhere along the way that I don't remember the number of years, but let's call it 3 years, that after 3 years with no new convictions, no new felonies by a sex offender, they are just as likely to commit an offense as someone that has never been convicted of offense. So now you're back to, I guess, somewhat of a zero level. You know, you're on parity, you're equal with the rest of the population. Have you heard anything like that before?
I've read those statistics after a period of years, that the risk is no more than the population as a whole. I don't make that my area of expertise. I'm aware
sure.
of that, and I believe that that would be true. It's one of those things where I'd spend less time on those statistics because that's not where I'm coming from on my consternation with registration. So, but yes, I am aware of that, and I do believe that that would you gravitate a person after offense-free living after a period of time. They're no more risky than the population as a whole.
Okay.
But the advocates for the laws will tell you that you are at risk because there's so much underreporting and underreported. So they will argue that just because the person hasn't been apprehended or prosecuted, that they're still probably offending undetected. That's what they put forth to promote their position.
Sure. So in all the things that you just described, the registry itself doesn't sound to be the position or the point that would make something unconstitutional. It is the further restrictions imposed by the laws that say you can't be here or can't be there, you can't be around this or that. But it's not the registry itself that would be unconstitutional.
That is my position. As I've spent many years researching this, merely requiring the government requiring a registration process to take place in and of itself is not unconstitutional. And we have to distinguish between what we like as a public policy and what is unconstitutional. It may not be the optimal public policy to register people who have been convicted of crimes, but the mere act of registering someone, we have dozens, if not hundreds, of registration schemes where the government requires registration. And some you don't get to opt out of. Most you are a voluntary thing where you can choose to vote. You can choose to own a firearm. You can choose towed a vehicle, but young men between the ages of 18 and 26, they can't choose not to register for the Selective Service. So that's not one where you opt out. But if you look at Selective Service registration, it's merely sending in a form. I think they're still available at post offices or going online, which I think they've upgraded to. I'm so old that I don't exactly know the most current process, but I believe that they can either still pick up a form or they can go online and register their information and keep it current without having any other additional restrictions imposed on them. So the mere act of the registration in and of itself would not tip the balance in a constitutional analysis that would be inflicting punishment. What you do as a part of the registration scheme can very well tip the balance and be found that those requirements are in fact inflicting punishment.
The registration scheme that I became familiar with most recently was if you have a drone, like a little quadcopter, and if it weighed more than, I want to say it was 250 grams, that you had to go to a website and pay them $5 and you get the little call letters that you might see on the back of an airplane. And I was trying to sort of make the comparison there with, well, I mean, that's a registration scheme. You have to register your vehicle, your drone. And you brought up the Selective Service. So, and you think that there are at least dozens, if not hundreds, of different kinds of registries. So a registry unto itself is not something that would be considered unconstitutional.
That is correct.
So how would we move into making something that is unconstitutional? Could you just, it doesn't have to be related to the registry, but can you give me something that would be unconstitutional?
Well, in the constitutional framework, we can just keep it to the registry because the registries that are unconstitutional have already been constructed in most states. So it's easy to analyze them. What the courts do is they look at a law. If a challenging party asserts that there's some infringement on a constitutional right, and it can be in the Constitution itself or in one of the Bill of Rights, but if there's a constitutional right this being trampled and infringed upon, a challenger has to bring that action to court, and they have to show by the clearest of proof that what is being done is a violation of the Constitution. Too often our people that don't like registries believe that courts are the savior from bad public policy, and they're not. They are to save us from constitutional intrusions when the lawmakers go too far, but the lawmakers get the benefit of the doubt. There's no stressing enough that, well, a challenging party, if they believe a constitutional infraction is occurring, the burden is on them. There's no presumption in the favor of unconstitutionality. The challenging party will have to show with clearest of proof that the act that they seek to nullify violates the Constitution. So laws are presumed constitutional. We elect people, and that's the careful balance in the constitutional creation of our republic, was to provide proper checks and balances. So most people wouldn't want robes making the laws. So the robes get to interpret the laws and determine if they've gone too far. So in terms of registration, there are a number of places where that they've gone too far. And the Supreme Court has recently spoken on that in terms of internet and social media restrictions in the case of. But prior to that, the Supreme Court spoke in terms of registration in a case called Smith versus Doe out of Alaska. And they carefully explained that we cannot find a constitutional defect with the Alaska scheme that's before us. And we can't find a constitutional defect because it doesn't impose any disability or restraint. And they went through a test that has been present since 1963, a case called Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez. And there are seven factors that they analyzed whether a registration scheme that's alleged to be civil and non-punitive and merely regulatory is actually, despite its intentions, inflicting punishment. And they didn't find any punishment being inflicted in Smith versus Doe.
But that was, 2003, right?
That was 2003. We're looking at almost 15 years ago.
Right. Where,
and there's been a lot added on since 2003.
Right. So where you might have just had something published on the internet, now you have all the extra baggage of you can't be here or there. Is that where you're going?
That is where I'm going. There were residency restrictions had not been thought of yet.
Right.
Restrictions on where people could be present hadn't been thought of yet. All those additional restrictions had not been imposed. And as I recall, they were merely returning a form periodically to verify their information in the Alaska scheme. Now, there was another case that they decided that same year, Doe versus Connecticut Department of Public Safety or vice versa. I forget which way it was, but the Connecticut case regarding publication. And at that time, they did not find that the internet of itself, in and of itself, merely listing was punitive. And they felt it was okay for Connecticut to list those pictures and that conviction information. That was at that time that they found that, at a time when the internet was still relatively young. It was a 2003 case, but understand that it takes years for cases to get to the Supreme Court. So
sure.
the underlying fact been established by statutory requirements that had been in place in the 90s before it ever reached the Supreme Court. And since if you look at Packingham, there's hope that they may be seeing the light in terms of what the merely listing people on the internet does. But the downside of that is that we've long since accepted in this country that conviction information is public, and that mug bookings, the mugshots that are taken of people, are public. So if they were to construct a registry where they merely took the conviction information from the date of conviction, and they merely took a photograph from the mugshot, and they placed that on the internet, there's a question of whether that would be punitive or not, because all that information is already out there. You have mugshots.com and all these mm-hmm. places where they re-disseminate arrest records already, and that's long since held to be constitutional. So that's going to be a tough one to crack in terms of the internet publication, but we have hope that we might get there going forward, because the internet is so wide-reaching, and the consequences for being on that list are so draconian that we have hope that maybe that they will rethink their position on whether that is, in fact, a constitutional violation.
Let me... So in France, they don't have the perp walk, where there's all the cameras around when someone's being pulled out of the police van or whatever. They suppress that, don't they?
I'm not sure whether France does that. I know that in recent years, I'm an older person pushing 60, and I know that perp walks have become far more common, and they serve a purpose for the law enforcement. But I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with what they do in other countries to say if they've prohibited those. But they're quite common here.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I bring it up, and I'm kind of stretching, so I could be wrong, but it seemed like I can't remember who the prime minister or the president of France was at the time, and. So I just remember them saying something about the whole perp walk. And I bring that up in comparison to our whole mugshot, the mugshot conversation that you're bringing up, that it almost makes it you're guilty just in the public's eye because you have been charged with something or you've been accused of. And once your information ends up in the local paper or in the national paper, it's hard to undo. And even when they do undo, they're going to put you on page 10 or 12 and they're going to make it in a really small font in the corner of the publication. So you almost can't get out of that public scrutiny at that point.
That's a discussion in a debate in a public policy arena that this country is going to have going forward, because the reach of information is so wide. And not too many years ago, 20 years ago, a person could start a new life. And right. If they had a history, they could leave it behind in one state or even one city within a state, and finding out their information would be very difficult, because in order to track down if a person had a criminal history, you had to actually visit the courthouse in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And then media stuff pretty much vanished after the publication went into the trash can, after the newspaper went into the trash can. And anything that was broadcast over the airwaves was costly and difficult to retrieve. None of that's true today.
Sure.
Everything lives forever.
Yes.
On the web. So we've built laws around an era that no longer exists, where a person could move past mistakes and be forgotten. A person can no longer be forgotten. So I think there's some law, case law developing in Europe. I think Robin, which is one of our colleagues, has spoken about that, a right to be forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And to have stuff that's in the electronic world restricted.
Right.
That's going to be a lot more difficult in the United States, because we have a commercial capitalist system, and money making has sprung up around dissemination of records. In fact, I deal with that regularly in my day job, where entities want public records at no cost so that they can sell those, become commercial purveyors of records that they've gotten for free, and they sue the state to make sure that they can get the records for free so they can resell those records. So once you have the commercialization of what happens in America, it's going to be difficult, because you have the media clamoring, saying we have the right to this information. A person's been arrested and booked through our jails that taxpayers are paying for. We have the right to know. The public has the right to know. And these records cannot be suppressed, because it's a disservice for employers who are trying to hire people. They need to know if their candidate for employment has been arrested, has an arrest history, so that they don't face negligent hiring. So it's going to be a very tough debate, but we're going to have that debate, because a significant percentage of Americans have arrest and conviction history, and it's becoming more and more problematic. And people's earnings, as we have proven with a criminal history, your capacity to earn and support yourself diminishes dramatically. And that's not in our collective interest of society, to have people marginalized and not able to get past the mistakes they've made and be a fully participating, productive member of society.
Sure. Sure. You used a term a few minutes ago, clearest of proof, and I'm unsure of what that means.
Well, that's a legal jargon, a terminology for a standard of proof. And the easiest way to relate that is to what you hear when you hear on a crime show, when you hear that that guilt has to be established beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the toughest standard we have. And this is the second highest standard of proof that's required. To when you look at the various standards, you know, you have reasonable suspicion, probable cause, preponderance of evidence, which in a civil proceeding is quite normal, which is tipping the evidentiary balance slightly in your favor, that you had a stronger case than the other side did. But the clearest of proof is a standard of evidence where the courts are saying, you're starting out, you're not in a good position here, because the presumption is that the law is constitutional. And you bear the burden of showing us, by a standard that's just shy of beyond a reasonable doubt, that this statutory scheme does not pass constitutional muster. So it's an evidentiary, it's a proof standard of one of the many that are required.
Okay. So can you then push the bar all the way to the point that it would take to make the registry itself unconstitutional?
Well, I think that has already occurred. the registry in most states is unconstitutional. The bar has already been pushed. There are enough restrictions where that the threshold has already been crossed. The problem is that there haven't been enough challenges, because the Smith versus Doe decision from the Supreme Court saying that that version was constitutional has intimidated. It's had a ripple effect all the way through the system. Courts below the level of the Supreme Court have felt that it was futile on their part, that it's binding. The Supreme Court's precedent that was set is binding upon them. So trial judges and all the courts below have said, well, the Supreme Court said it's okay. I may personally not agree with it. So, and then there's been few challenges mounted because lawyers look at the Supreme Court decision and they said, well, this is already decided. This is in the cake is already baked on this. I can't win this. And a constitutional challenge is very expensive, because whatever governmental entity has enacted that, be it state or be it a city, generally will expend whatever resources are necessary to defend those laws. In the case of the federal government, they will defend it with all vigor and all resources that the federal government can muster. So there has been woefully litigation has been woefully inadequate in terms of the cases that have been challenging registration. And they've been underfunded because the registered population, as we mentioned earlier, typically their earnings are suppressed by the fact they're on this registry, even if they can find a job. So the financial resources to challenge the states has been lacking. So the challenges have not been there, but they're beginning to come. And that's what we saw in the case of Doe's versus Michigan. That case, Doe's versus Snyder, is actually the title. We saw that there was a challenge, and the outcome has been favorable towards the challenging parties. The second highest court in the United States, Court of Appeals, found that the registry as it exists in Michigan today is in fact punitive as applied to those challengers.
But that also, that case was with, I don't remember how many, it was three or six people that pushed back, because when they were convicted back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, they didn't have all the restrictions. So then those restrictions were piled on, the living restrictions, the reporting restrictions. So that case only impacts it from that perspective. It doesn't have things to do with people that are put on the registry now, does it?
Well, that is true. Since the challenge was only based on people who had legal standing, and their standing, they weren't put on it going forward. They were put on it retroactively, so right, they were not able to bring a challenge for the new people. And we can get into the doctrine of legal standing if you like. So that was not an issue before the court, whether it was punitive as applied going to people going forward. But what that made clear was that within the states that make up the Sixth Circuit, those states are going to have a careful look at their registry, because a line has been drawn that you cannot do the things that Michigan was trying to impose and call it a civil regulatory scheme. And they had some pretty extensive residency restrictions. And then they changed the duration of people's registration, who thought they were going to be exiting the system. And they said, oh, by the way, never mind that. We've got this new version, and you're going to be on it forever without any due process. So the court found problems with no due process and then all the impediments that have been erected. But they didn't say you can't have a registration scheme that's non-punitive. They said you cannot apply this registration scheme retroactively.
Right, and that goes to ex post facto. So can you go over that super quick, what ex post facto means?
Well, ex post facto is a protection in the Constitution to prevent either a prosecution for something that was not unlawful, or the imposition of a penalty, a stricter, more severe penalty than what was available at the time the act occurred. So when you look at ex post facto analysis, you're looking at the act that was committed, and the penalty scheme and the punishment and the deprivations that the courts could impose on a person at the time. So this was not available to be imposed at the time because it didn't exist. Ex post facto analysis merely is, you can't punish people more severely than what was available at the time the act occurred, or you can't create a punishment that didn't exist at the time the act occurred. And that's what we've done through registration schemes that's been done all over the country. It's been at the behest of law enforcement and victims advocates to figure out ways to inflict additional punishment on people because it feels good to them and they deserved it. And if they're out in the free world, let's figure out a way to make their life miserable. They should have thought about this before they did the crime. Well, they couldn't have thought about it because these things didn't exist. So there was no way to take this into consideration.
Sure. And that is something that the Constitution protects us against, is those kind of things coming up and after the fact, putting some sort of restriction or punishing you after the fact.
It's one of the strongest protections in our Constitution that we have is the ex post facto clause. I am not aware of an exception to the ex post facto clause. When you look at other, even like the Second Amendment, which is precious to so many, it's not an absolute. We restrict people's rights to own guns. If you're right. convicted felon, if you've been mentally found to be mentally defective, there's a variety of restrictions that have been upheld by the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. But the ex post facto law is that provision. Excuse me, that ex post facto provision is absolute. You cannot create a punishment or increase a punishment after the crime has been committed.
Interesting. And so we have 27 amendments. Is that right? It's 27?
I believe so.
Okay. And do only some of them apply? Maybe like just the Bill of Rights? Do those come under the purview of being constitutional, or do we get to look at all 27?
Well, we also get to look at those 27 plus the Constitution itself.
So you have these the elements of the Constitution, and then you have the amendments. How does that play differently for someone that is completely finished with their sentence or someone that is on supervision, either parole or probation?
Well, a person under state control or system control, there's federal probation and federal supervised release as well as state probation and parole. They have a diminished expectation of constitutional rights because they're paying their debt to society, but they do have constitutional rights. So it's very tricky because supervising authorities like to push the envelope in terms of what they tell you that they can do. And for example, the right to freedom of worship has not been extinguished. So a person under supervision has a right to worship. And that cannot be taken away. And we go to great lengths in prison settings to make sure that we provide for the free exercise of some opportunity for people to practice their religious.
Can we dig into that one for just a minute? Can supervision prohibit you from worship in any case? I mean, I think I worded that poorly. Can they prevent you from doing worship? Absolutely.
Well, if it were to be a blanket ban of saying you will not worship, that would be very problematic and would not withstand. That would be a facial invalid. We can get into what a challenge would look like. But if they were to narrowly tailor it to a particular person's unique characteristics, which is what they do have the right to do, is to narrowly tailor and impose restrictions that are appropriate for that person. So, for example, if the person had offended as an employee of a particular church,
right,
it would probably be okay to tailor some restrictions that you can't go back to that church. And you can't have certain access to parts of the church family, but to just say you cannot worship, period. You gave that right up. You don't give that right up. So that's an example. But there are rights you do give up. Your right to privacy is greatly diminished. Your right to mobility and travel is greatly diminished while a person's under supervision. A search and seizure is greatly diminished. In terms in some jurisdictions, there'll be a level of reasonable suspicion. But in some jurisdictions, it's just accepted that we're going to search. Your house is going to be subject to search at any time for any reason.
Well, why did we make that distinction between the First and the Fourth Amendments then? I mean, how do I word this? And I know you're not a constitutional lawyer, but are constitutional amendments and the Constitution itself, are they weighted in some way? So does the Fourth Amendment have less value than the First Amendment?
Well, apparently in a correctional setting, yes, because you've got, although these people are not in institutional settings per se, they're still paying their debt to society. So while you're paying your debt to society. Clearly, you don't have the right to travel and navigate the globe as the way you might want to as a free citizen. And part of the purpose of probation and supervision is to monitor and control and rehabilitate. So if they don't have access to know what you're doing, it's very difficult to rehabilitate. So if they can't do some intense scrutiny of what's going on in an offender's life, a lot of stuff could fall through the cracks. That's their rationale for that. And the courts have been very, very generous with allowing them that latitude to monitor a person's behavior, because supposedly it's for rehabilitative purposes and to keep the person from protecting. We're also trying to, when we have people in the community serving their sentences, there's a public safety component that's being considered as how, what can you do to carefully balance their rights with also balancing the rights of public safety and detecting risky behavior and doing something before they act.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you. I understand. So then I guess we could move on to, and not that either of us are experts on other countries, but other countries determine what they deem as their constitution, and they might favor or disfavor principles that we have in the United States. But so is there a difference between something of a universal right, such as, you know, is it there are natural rights versus legal rights?
Well, our Constitution alludes to that by the inalienable rights I suppose that the people that wrote that thought there were some rights that just flowed down from being created. But there are some international agreements where we've agreed, the United States is signatory to, and I can't cite any off the top of my head, but we have agreed to certain universal rights.
Well,
but the U.S. Constitution. Go ahead.
So if we are constructing registries and restrictions on people to the point that they are living in warehouse districts as they are in the county in Florida, and then they have to travel 2 or 3 hours to get to work each way, aren't we essentially creating a situation where the people are impoverished and potentially starving to death?
I think there's not any question that we have people that are suffering great harm because of these restrictions. And it's unfortunate that we haven't been able to do enough to push back on those restrictions. Yes, there's a lot, not just in Florida. There's people living in wooded areas all over the country.
Sure, sure. Do you have any sort of suggestions or hope that things might be changing to get better for us?
Well, I do. There's been just a number of cases that give me that hope of the Doe's versus Snyder case out of Michigan, which made it to the second highest court in the land. And then the U.S. Supreme Court said that they were going to let the decision stand undisturbed. And then we had the Packingham case out of the Supreme Court on the social media of prohibition. And then there's a number of state court decisions that have been handed down through the years. And even in some conservative states, such as Oklahoma, in the case of Starkey, we've got hope that with the momentum of these cases, both at the state and federal level, that we're going to at least be able to begin to hold the line on new enhancements to the registry. And then the longer term goal is to bring more challenges. There's a case pending in Alabama that's at the Circuit Court of Appeals, and their registry in Alabama is so horrible. They put sexual offender in bright letters on the driver's license, and they're required to have that on the person at all times, or a state ID that says the same thing. And several southern states have similar requirements.
Isn't that compelled speech, though?
That is a very good argument. It hasn't been asserted in state litigation. Now, it was asserted in the International Megan's Law Challenge that was filed a year and a half or so ago. And that case hasn't gotten any traction yet.
Isn't
that is an argument that,
isn't that similar to like on Halloween where they have you post a sign or whatever, don't trick or treat here because there's a sex offender here? Isn't that the same thing, or at least similar?
I think those are clear-cut cases of compelled speech. And to my knowledge, those haven't been litigated. But now that we have some momentum with victories, the hope is that it'll be easier to assemble challenges because attorneys will be willing. When you're undertaking a constitutional challenge, it's a full-blown fight, and they're going to throw everything they have at it.
Yeah.
So even solo practitioners and two-person law firms really can't do constitutional challenges effectively, you're looking at committing hundreds of hours of your time and never being paid for. But now that some of these cases, particularly in federal court, are going in a favorable direction, there's the opportunity to win and collect attorney's fees on the backside as a prevailing party.
And then
that's something that doesn't exist at most state courts.
Right. And then I guess at that point, an organization like NARSAL, if they had enough money coming in, enough revenue, that they would hire an attorney, and then you have someone that can, for their full-time job, go challenge these things.
Well, that is something where we're looking at. We would never be able to fund a full-blown constitutional challenge because you can easily run into hundreds of thousands in billable hours. But where we're hoping to make a difference at NARSAL is to have money for the out-of-pocket case-related costs. So you're asking the attorney, the law firm, to wait for their payment on the backside of what they're going to get paid for their hourly fees for their paralegals and for themselves. But we're not also asking you to pull the cost out of your pocket and wait for those on the backside. So we're trying to partner with law firms and provide them some help without out-of-pocket cost. We did that in the case that's pending right now in federal court in Rhode Island, where there was a challenge asserted because the Rhode Island legislature decided that they would increase the prohibition of an offender residing from 300 feet to 1,000 feet, and they would apply that prohibition retroactively. So law enforcement had dutifully notified offenders that even though you've been in these homes for all these years, you now have to leave. So a challenge was brought by the Rhode Island ACLU, and that being a very small chapter of the ACLU, they were having questions about how they were going to fund the out-of-pocket costs, because we're going to need experts to testify about the efficacy of the residency restriction, and about that they don't actually achieve any of their stated objective. So we've raised money for that case, and that's the type of model that NARSAL is looking at as helping to soften the blow on out-of-pocket case-related costs.
All right, I just a couple more things. How can you get convicted of a crime, and in that particular state, you are then on the registry for life, even though you may have a 10 or a 20 or even, you know, whatever, a 50-year sentence? Once you're done, how is the argument presented that could be something that you have to do for the remainder of your life?
Well, it's unfortunate because so many states have at least a component of their registrants that are required to be on the registry for life. It would be possible that if we talked about earlier, having a truly benign registration scheme where all that was required would be to mail in a form, it's possible that could withstand a constitutional challenge if that was all that's required, and you could require a person to do that for life. But what we have is people effectively being on probation for the rest of their life because of the frequency. The lifetime registration requirement is accompanied by an every 90-day or sometimes more frequent check-in with law enforcement to be fingerprinted, to have another mugshot made, to update all the information about where you're working, who's living in your home with you, and being told that, oh, by the way, there's a new restriction starting. You've got to give us information about the children that are in your home. It's a constantly moving target of what you have to do. So lifetime registration in and of itself may not be unconstitutional, but the way it's being applied, I believe in most instances, would not withstand a good constitutional challenge.
And then just to extend that, if you don't register, it's a felony.
Well, that is true in most states, not all. It is a felony level offense. Not complying with any regulatory scheme is a crime. Very few of them rise to level of felonies, but it's not uncommon to have a penalty. Otherwise, there would be no teeth to the registry, to the regulatory scheme that's required if nothing happened, if you didn't comply.
Do you know of anything where you don't register? You said very few rise to that level. Is there? Can you think of anything else that rises to that level?
I can't think of anything where it's a felony level. I do know that there are collateral consequences for failing to register for the draft. The young men forego their right to educational benefits, and there are some collateral consequences, but I don't believe it's a felony level prosecution.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts on the idea of a registry being public versus private?
as a non-supporter of registries, I would hope that the day would come when we wouldn't do either. But if we're determined to have registration, if the public, if that's their will, is expressed through their lawmakers, we would certainly think a private registry would take a lot of the horrors out of what's in the public system, because the discrimination, the harassment, the ridicule, and in some cases we've had offenders and their families killed. We had a couple in South Carolina where both the registrant and his wife were killed, and there's so many incidents that happened that we intuitively know from what happened that it was directly related to revenge for being on the registry. But unless the law enforcement has the smoking gun, they'll say that there's no proof that it was related to the registry, of course, because they want the registry to live on. But we've had cases where they have announced, I believe in Maine and in up in Washington State, there's been a couple of cases where they were deliberately announced that they were targeting registrants, so law enforcement was not able to pretend that there was no connection there. But yes, it would be a preferable registry if we have to have a registry. I'm hoping that I see the day that most registries are determined or relegated to the ash heaps of history, because I'm not convinced that they provide any public good. Right. It's certainly not discernible by the statistics that we see. There's no proof that they make a difference in a measurable way.
Sure, sure. Larry, I am out of questions. Do you have any final thoughts on this subject of dealing with the registry in general?
Well, my final thoughts would be that the advocacy groups, there are a few of them out there. I think NARSL is the oldest and the largest. But people that their families they're going to have to become involved with these advocates that are working tirelessly, trying to fight the system. It's a monumental fight. Government has resources that we can never match, but the families are going to have to step up. The registrants themselves are going to have to step up. And when I say step up, it means a variety of things. We need people who have skill sets. We need people who are willing to put a few dollars in. And people who are better off financially need to put a few more dollars in. And we need to continue the path that we're going, which is a good path. The trends are good, but we need to be able to accelerate. I would like to be able to get on that challenge in Oklahoma right away. What's holding us back is I don't have money.
Yeah.
I have a lawyer ready to go, but he needs funding. And,
sure.
And he feels the best place to be in Oklahoma is in state court.
But do you want to plug that real quick? How would someone donate some money to help Oklahoma?
Well, we would have to set up where we're negotiating, trying to set up some kind of agreement in terms of the scope of the litigation. But if we come to an agreement and a plan, we would probably announce that through the NARSL, through the Oklahoma affiliate, through our tentacles. But it would be premature at this point to plug for donations, because we don't have a memorandum and we don't have a plan in place at this point. But I would like to be able, when I spoke with the attorney who was successful in the Starkey case, I would like to been able to tell him, well, I'm sitting on cash right now. You know, I need to see your plan. We're ready to go. And I have to tell him, well, I can possibly get cash, but let's come up with a plan so that we can go out and pitch the need for cash.
Sure, 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 sure.
That's where we are as an organization and as a cause.
Well, that's great. Larry, that's all I got. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. If you have questions, send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or you can give us a call at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 1. We will do our best to respond to you. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would be more than honored if you did.